History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hello, everyone. In this episode, we're going to be talking about somebody very interesting. And before I introduce him, I want to give you an idea of what he's like by means of analogy. And with this analogy, I'm going to be using my beloved rogue, traitorous character from the Revolutionary War, Benedict Arnold. And if you want to know why I'm so interested in him, listen back to the Revolutionary War episodes I did with James Early. So here's the analogy. Imagine if Benedict Arnold, after he defects from America, he goes to fight for England. After this, he then doesn't remain a loyal English general. He then conspires with France during the Napoleonic Wars, and he switches sides yet again. But during the course of the War of 1812, America is losing, and they realize they have to ask Benedict Arnold to come back and fight for them because his military skills are so desperately needed, even though he betrayed them. He's then granted the position of general, and he wins the entire War of 1812 against the British. What would we think of Benedict Arnold then? I mean, he was still a traitor, but we would have to respect him in a different way. He's a capable general. He's also a smooth operator who knows how to play off other people, like a James Bond. But he's almost like a Loki, the god of mischief, that you simply can't trust him, and you know that he's always playing some type of angle. Whatever we would think of him, we would never look up to him as a great statesman like an Abraham Lincoln or Winston Churchill. Well, that's what we have in the figure of the ancient Greek character Alcibiades, one of the most important people in the Peloponnesian War. He was called by Greek and Roman writers the chameleon, and for good reason. Alcibiades was born in 450 BC in Athens, and he died in 404 BC in Phrygia, which is now in western Turkey. And he was a brilliant but unscrupulous Athenian politician and military commander who provoked sharp political antagonisms at Athens. And because of what he did, because of how he contributed to the war effort, he was majorly, if not primarily, responsible for the defeat of Athens by Sparta in the Peloponnesian War. The Peloponnesian War was a huge war between the two city-states, and it lasted from 431 to 405 BC. And because Sparta won, it made them the most powerful city-state in the region. So Alcibiades wasn't just involved in conflicts between Athens and Sparta. He was involved in the conflicts between ideas of governing system, whether democracy or oligarchy or tyranny should be the primary form of government, when all these things were being contested at the time. And Alcibiades switched to whatever system benefited the most. Depending on the circumstances, he could be said to be a proponent of each different form of regime. And his shifting alliances didn't just involve Athens and Sparta, they also involved Persia, as all parties within Athens and Greece were seeking Persian support in the Peloponnesian War. So here are a few bullet points of Alcibiades' life before we dive into detail in this episode. He's first exiled from Athens for specific reasons, and then he's sentenced to death, but he escapes. Then he goes to Sparta, where he's a general there, but he's exiled again, and he's sentenced to death, and he escapes. During all this time, he is sleeping with basically everybody's wives, which is part of the reason he gets into so much trouble, and some think is the reason that he's eventually executed. He's a collaborator with the Persians, considered an enemy by all Greeks, although many Greeks do collaborate with the Persians as well. He's a member of the Greek deep state, if we can call it that, and I'll explain what that means there. He's an Olympic chariot champion. He's an owner of various chariot teams. And lastly, he is a student of Socrates, and he's featured in many Socratic dialogues. The impetus for this episode comes from listener Aaron Webster, and he asks this question. In regards to the Peloponnesian War, I think my favorite player is Alcibiades. This guy was all over the place. He has to be one of the most interesting characters in history. The charisma he must have had transitioning from Athens to Sparta, then to Persia, and then back to Athens again. All right, well, I agree with you. Alcibiades it is. He is a fascinating person to look at. So we're going to be looking at the life of Alcibiades, but not just his life. We're going to look at What makes for a successful politician, military general? What makes somebody appear in the pantheon of elite leaders of all time? The Abraham Lincolns, the Julius Caesars, people who hold their state or empire together in times of severe crisis? And what makes somebody not that? What makes somebody like an Alcibiades who isn't simply a survivor? He's below that. He's more like an opportunist, I guess you could say. A supremely talented individual, but a very flawed individual all the time. But at the same time, somebody who you have to respect. I mean, they can switch sides constantly, and then he's so skilled that the people he betrays and fights against wants him back to fight for them. If Benedict Arnold were so skilled that America would forgive his treason and accept him back, that's what we have in the character of Alcibiades. All right, well, he appears in all sorts of ancient sources. He appears, for example, in Plato's Dialogue, and there's a whole conversation happening between Socrates and Alcibiades. He appears in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, and that's a lot of the information that we have about him. He appears in Xenophon's Hellenica and Memorabilia, Aristophanes' plays. He appears in Plutarch's Lives of the Noble Greeks and Romans, or Parallel Lives, where the biography of Alcibiades is compared to that of Coriolanus. Coriolanus is a 5th century BC Roman general who's known for exceptional bravery in the Roman siege of an enemy city, but then he's later exiled from Rome, and he led the troops of Rome's enemy to besiege the city of Rome. Alcibiades, interestingly enough, if you want to see a more contemporary source, he is in the 2018 video game Assassin's Creed Odyssey. He's a character friendly to the protagonist. He's depicted as being extremely charming and amorous, wanting to sleep with anyone and anyone he can, male or female. And he also constantly has an intent to gain power and influence later on through deceit and ruthlessness. That's an accurate depiction of Alcibiades, and in an earlier episode, I interviewed one of the historical consultants for Assassin's Creed, so gotta give them credit, they had their game together. All right, so let's dig in into more detail into the life of Alcibiades. He was born in 451 or 450 BC, not exactly sure, the calendar reckoning ancient Greece doesn't quite correspond to a Gregorian calendar. He's the son of the Athenian politician Cleonas, and his mother, Dianake. She was from the ancient aristocratic family, the Alcmenidae. Alcibiades was also the nephew of the great Athenian statesman Pericles, and he spent his childhood in the family household of the famous uncle. As a young man, he was also the pupil and friend of Socrates, so he was born with every advantage possible. Total aristocratic, gilded upbringing gives him plenty of advantages. Another advantage is that Alcibiades is remarkably handsome. Chroniclers constantly mention this fact. This is what makes him so successful with the wives of many other friends and rivals. So he's rich, he's handsome, his family is one of the most distinguished in Greece. Alcibiades seems to have the world by the tail, and he has an incredibly fast rise through the political system of Athens. He meets the who's who of ancient Greece. Now, that doesn't mean that he doesn't have challenges when he's growing up. When he is a young boy, his father dies. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't have challenges when he was growing up. He was only a small boy when his father, who was in command of the Athenian army, was killed in 447 or 446 BC. So Alcibiades' guardian was Pericles. He was a distant relation, but he's too preoccupied with his own political career to be too involved in the guidance of Alcibiades. And a bit more about Pericles, he was a general during the Athenian Golden Age, specifically the time between the Persian and the Peloponnesian Wars. As he grew up, Alcibiades was, again, strikingly handsome and keen-witted, but he was considered extravagant, irresponsible, and self-centered. But he was impressed by the moral strength and mind of the philosopher Socrates, who in turn was attracted by Alcibiades' beauty and intellectual promise. And there's all sorts of speculation on whether the two of them had a romantic fling. Good reason to suspect that they did. At the age of 20, Alcibiades received an award for bravery for his actions at the Battle of Potidae in 432. This battle was one of the catalysts for the Peloponnesian War. It was fought near Potidae in 432 BC between Athens and a combined army from Corinth and Potidae, along with their various allies. He and Socrates served together here, where Alcibiades was defended by Socrates when he was wounded, a debt that Alcibiades repaid when he stayed to protect Socrates in the flight from the Battle of Delium in 424 BC, north of Athens. Alcibiades then got married, but he had a stormy marriage. He was married to Hipparete, the daughter of Hipponicus, a wealthy Athenian. His bride brought with her a large dowry, which significantly increased Alcibiades' already considerable family fortune. According to Plutarch, Hipparate loved her husband, but she attempted to eventually divorce him because he consorted with courtesans or prostitutes. But he managed to prevent her from divorcing him and by keeping her from appearing in court. He seized her in court and carried her home again through the crowded agora. Before Alcibiades was the age of 30, he abandoned the philosophical path of Socrates and the intellectual integrity that the philosopher demanded in favor of the awards that came with politics and the kind of politics that Socrates despised. He's perhaps the most gifted Athenian of his generation. He had great charm, brilliant political and military abilities, great political connections. He was wealthy, but he was completely unscrupulous. When he advised Athens or later on Sparta or whether on Persia, whether to democrats or to oligarchs or to tyrants, it was almost always dictated by selfish motives. And Athenians could never trust him enough to take advantage of his talents. Moreover, his adversaries, most especially the radical leader Cleon and his successors, carry on a bitter feud with him, and this undermined Athenian confidence. So Alcibiades didn't have the discipline and the virtue of Socrates, and this ultimately led to his downfall. During the 420s BC, Alcibiades was known for his personal extravagance and his courage in battle, but he also became a recognized speaker in the assembly, or the ecclesia, and as Athens moved toward peace with Sparta, he hoped that the ties that once existed between his family and Sparta would enable him to secure credit for bringing peace to Athens. According to the historian Thucydides, who knew Alcibiades well and judged him mostly dispassionately, it was the fact that the Spartans chose to negotiate through established political leaders that dictated Alcibiades' subsequent choice of politics. And I'll say what I mean by that. Basically, it led to a lot of political backroom dealing for him to try to secure power and secure alliances against Sparta. At 31, he became one of Athens' best-known orators. He opposed the Peace of Nicias that was made in 421 BC with Sparta, which was a 50-year peace between Athens and Sparta that ended the first half of the Peloponnesian War. Plutarch says that Alcibiades was a most able speaker in addition to his other gifts, while the Roman writer Theophrastus argues that Alcibiades was the most capable of discovering and understanding what was required in a given case. He was an opportunist. Nevertheless, he would often stumble in the midst of his speeches, but then he would resume and proceed with all the caution in the world. Some say that he had a lisp, which was noticed by Aristophanes, and he says that this wasn't a strike against him, but it was a flaw that he turned into an asset. He said it made his talk persuasive and full of charm. In some senses, Alcibiades is like a theater character. He's a figure that instead of following the Delphic norm of nothing in excess, he, as they would say in ancient Greece, provoked the nemesis, the punishment of the gods, by seemingly doing everything in excess. And he lives a life of a sexual libertine, but sometimes he was also like an austere Spartan. He acted the role of an Athenian aristocrat, but he could also act to be a man of the people and try to champion Athenian democracy when it suited him. So whether delivering speeches in Athens, commanding an army on land or a navy at sea, riding horses in Thrace, navigating Persian politics, or working the Persian court, or possibly seducing the wife of one of the Spartan kings, he seemed to have excelled at almost everything, but eventually it leads to his downfall. So let's get back to our historical narrative. In 420 BC, Alcibiades was made a general, or strategos, which you had to be at a minimum age of 30 to do so, and he became a member of the strategoi, the military council in Athens, which could propose items for the agenda of the assembly. Alcibiades wasted no time at all in this new role. He opposed the aristocratic leader Nicias, who had negotiated peace, and he steered Athens into an anti-Spartan alliance with Argos, Elis, and Mantineia. These are three city-states of the Peloponnese, and this alliance lasts 100 years. Alcibiades would go on to hold the position of strategos for 15 consecutive years. This alliance was defeated by Sparta at the Battle of Mantinei in 418. So Alcibiades, even though he proposed a battle and alliance that ultimately led to defeat, he was able to escape ostracism through his wits. Okay, so what is ostracism? Ostracism, this is interesting. It's not just people shun you informally. It is a formal means of banishment in which you're kicked out of the city for a set period of time. The way he was able to avoid this was by joining forces with Nicias against Hyperbolus, who is the successor of the demagogue politician Cleon, as a champion of the common people. The reason he was almost ostracized first for the alliance that he put together face to face in battle is also because of other enemies that came up against him. His ambition aroused opposition among Athenians, likely encouraged by the Nicias Peace Treaty. So ostracism, just a little bit more about that. This is interesting. It's a procedure under the Athenian democracy in which any citizen can be expelled from the city-state of Athens for 10 years. Some instances clearly express popular anger at the citizen, but ostracism, it's not mob justice. It's usually used as a way of neutralizing someone thought to be a threat to the state or a potential tyrant. So it's usually used preemptively. A little bit more about ostracism. Each year, the Athenians were asked in the assembly whether they wished to hold an ostracism. According to Plutarch, ostracism was considered valid if the total number of votes cast was at least 6,000. The person nominated for ostracism, if the vote passed, had 10 days to leave the city. If he attempted to return, the penalty was death. Notably, the property of the man banished wasn't confiscated, and there was no loss of status. So after 10 years, he was allowed to return without stigma. And it was possible for the assembly to recall an ostracized person ahead of time. For example, before the Persian invasion of 479 BC, an amnesty was declared in which a few leaders, one of them was Pericles' father, Xanthippus, is known to have returned. So ostracism is useful because if someone is a threat to Athenian democracy, you can get rid of them, but they're not just going to run off and join an enemy. If they're a high-ranking person, they probably have state secrets, and you don't want them to tell Sparta or the Persians or another city-state. So they don't want to betray Athens because their property is still there. And if they betray Athens, all their property could be forfeit, and they're still loyal to some degree, and they want to stay on good terms, and they can return peacefully. Anyway, he was able to escape the vote of ostracism, but his ambition is only further inflamed after this, and Alcibiades turns his attention to the 91st Olympic Games in 416 BC, where he makes a power play. He was able to restore his reputation by single-handedly entering 7 horses into the Olympic chariot race, so he places first, second, and fourth. This is a splashy thing to do. This would be like owning 2 or 3 NFL teams, and 2 of your teams are vying for the Super Bowl. Another one makes the playoffs and almost makes it to the Super Bowl. This is what he does. So this is extravagant on his part. This really endears him to the masses who love the Olympics, who love the chariot races. Most of them were poor, but they also become deeply suspicious of him. And they think, what angle is he playing? What is he doing here? But this move did get him popularity with those in power and led to him leading what is known as the Sicilian Expedition. He managed to persuade the Athenian democracy to undertake an incredibly ambitious plan to conquer the distant island of Sicily, waging a naval battle far away from home when supply lines are stretched, and then conquering an island far away and then maintaining control of it is a very ambitious thing to do at this time in history, in the 5th century BC. The pretext for the Sicilian campaign happened in 416 or 415 BC when Segesta, a city-state in the west of Sicily, asked Athens for help against local rival Selinius, who was allied with Syracuse. So Alcibiades had imperial ambition, but he also might have been after the wood and the timber of Sicily. This is an important material for the Athenian navy. You build ships out of it and other things too. It's the backbone of your navy. Alcibiades argued that the mixed race population and political instability in Sicily would make a strong and unified military response unlikely. He knows how to demagogue when he needs to. Here's what he said according to Thucydides to convince others of the Sicilian expedition. Men do not rest content with parrying the attacks of a superior, but often strike the first blow to prevent the attack being made. And we cannot fix the exact point at which our empire shall stop. We have reached a position in which we must not be content with retaining, but must scheme to expand it. For if we cease to rule others, we are in danger of being ruled ourselves. Nor can you look at inaction from the same point of view as others, unless you are prepared to change your habits and make them like theirs. So he's getting them the idea that if we don't strike, other people will try to set up a colony here. So ultimately, it's to preserve Athenian peace and Athenian democracy. Alcibiades promised that the Persians could be persuaded to assist Athens if certain constitutional changes were made. In the end, he wins the vote of the assembly, despite the doubts expressed by his rivals, Nicias, and 2 generals. along with Lamados, who were given the equal status of strategoi autocratores, unlimited power. And this group, this junta, is sent along with 6,000 men and 60 ships to protect Segesta. Alcibiades was appointed to share the command, but before the expedition sets out, something happens to him that leads to his first downfall in Athens. Before the expedition set sail, Alcibiades was probably the victim of an infamous conspiracy. The Hermae, which were statues with the head of the god Hermes and a large erect phallus, this is pretty common in ancient Greece, these statues were set up in public places throughout the city, and the statues were found to have been mutilated. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Sailors of the Athenian fleet, and the sailors, like all sailors before them and a lot of sailors since, were a very superstitious lot. And as Hermes was the patron of travelers, their confidence was badly shaken by the attacks on these statues. According to popular opinion, the attacks on the Hermae were connected to an attack on the democratic system of Athens. And many people thought that Alcibiades did this. He was known as one of the golden youth of the aristocracy and being frivolous, and they thought that he was the prime suspect, along with several others. To make matters a lot worse, Alcibiades at the same time is also accused of a much more serious accusation of profaning the mysteries of Eleosis. The mysteries of Eleosis were a secret religious rite of ancient Greece. Very, very sacred, and it was said that he profaned them during a drinking party. Well, Alcibiades demanded an immediate inquiry in order to clear his name, but he thought that a conspiracy was set up against him by enemies and there was a whisper campaign against him. But his enemies, who were led by Androcles, the successor of Hyperbolus, ensured that Alcibiades set sail with the charges still hanging over his head. Shortly after he reached Sicily, he was recalled, but on the journey home, he escaped. He feared that he would be found guilty, it would be a kangaroo court, and he learned that he had been condemned in absentia to death. The anti-Spartan Alcibiades needed a solution. He needs somewhere to turn to. He couldn't return to his home. So he becomes a refugee, and he becomes a refugee of, in all places, Sparta, the enemy of Athens during the Peloponnesian War. So this is his running away. This is when I was making the analogy of Benedict Arnold earlier. This is what inspired that idea of someone who runs away to an enemy camp. In the middle of a full-throated war, he joins the enemy. So he contacted the Spartans and he said he promised to render aid and service greater than all the harm he had previously done to them as an enemy if they would offer him sanctuary. The Spartans agreed. They did it. They granted this request and received him among them. Because of this defection, the Athenians condemned him to death in absentia, and they confiscated his property. In the debate at Sparta over whether to send a force to relieve Syracuse, Alcibiades, he immediately makes himself useful. He immediately gets involved in the Spartan political system and Spartan military planning. So when Sparta is deciding whether or not to send a force to relieve Syracuse during the siege that Alcibiades was originally a part of with Athens, he spoke and instilled fear of Athenian ambition into the Spartan leaders by informing them that the Athenians hoped to conquer Sicily, Italy, and even Carthage itself. That would be insanely ambitious, and there's almost no way that Athens was actually planning something like that. So Yale historian Donald Keegan thinks that Alcibiades knowingly exaggerated the plans of the Athenians in order to convince the Spartans of the benefit that they stood to gain from his help. He was trying to make himself invaluable to them, that Athens could conquer the known Mediterranean, but I have intelligence of Athens and let me into your councils, give me leadership, and I'm going to save you from destruction. So Keegan says that Alcibiades hadn't yet acquired his legendary reputation that he later would, and the Spartans saw him as a defeated and hunted man whose policies produced strategic failure and brought no decisive result. But all of that really goes to show Alcibiades' greatest talent, which is ability to persuade others to follow his lead. So after making this threat of Athenian conquest seem imminent, Alcibiades advises the Spartans to send troops and, most importantly, a Spartan commander to discipline and aid the Syracusans. So he's now serving Sparta. He aids Sparta in ways that really do damage to Athens. He advises Sparta to build a permanent fort at Decele, or Decele. This is over about 10 miles from Athens, and it's within sight of the city. By building this fort, the Spartans cut the Athenians off entirely from their homes and crops. They can't farm the land around Athens. And they also cut them off from the silver mines of Sunium. Alcibiades became the architect of Spartan victories as well, and he made himself useful to his new host. According to his accusers in Athens, he freely gave Athenian state secrets to the Spartans. This was part of Alcibiades' plan to renew the war with Athens in Attica. This move devastated the Athenians, and it forced the citizens to live within the city walls year-round, so now they're entirely dependent on their seaborne trade for food, and they're particularly vulnerable for anything that happens to shipping routes. In the wake of Athens' disastrous defeat in Sicily, the expedition failed. Alcibiades sailed to Ionia with a Spartan fleet, and he succeeded in persuading several cities to revolt. Meanwhile, the Athenian expedition, as I was saying, it was a complete disaster, their expedition to Sicily, and it ended in total defeat in 414 BC. It also led to the loss of Nicias and the general Demosthenes. He was a military leader during the Peloponnesian War. Alcibiades also confirmed his reputation with women at this time, and he got into a lot of trouble in Sparta, most notably by seducing Timonassa, the wife of the Spartan king Agis II, who at the time was away with his army. That was a very, very bad move. In 412, Alcibiades stirred up revolts among the Athenian allies in Ionia, as I was talking about, on the west coast of Asia Minor. That's where they're located. But at this time, Sparta turns against him. And in addition to sleeping with leaders' wives, according to Xenophon, Alcibiades had advised the Spartans to send the general Glypios to the besieged Sicilians, but he fell out of favor with Sparta, in particular with the king. He's condemned to death, but not for the reasons that I mentioned. He's condemned for treason, for suspected or perhaps actual loyalty to the Persians and talking with them through back channels, which at this time was the traditional enemy of all Greeks alike. Alcibiades flees again. He is a refugee again. He now goes to Sardis, which is an area in western Turkey today, or western Anatolia, and he's trained to now work his charm on the Persian court. He contacts the Persian governor there, the satrap Tissaphernes. And Persia at this time had been giving aid to Sparta so that they might build a fleet to rival Athens. So this is the point of connection that he has. Here's what Alcibiades first did. He encouraged Persia to keep on friendly terms with both Athens and Sparta, and he tried to convince the satrap that it was in Persia's interest to wear both Athens and Sparta down by allowing the two sides just to fight each other. And after their power is reduced, then the Persians could completely rid their country of the Peloponnesians. Alcibiades' advice benefited the Persians, but of course, it wasn't to help the Persians. He was, again, working an angle here, and it was just a means to an end. Thucydides says that the real reason he was doing this was to use his influence with the Persians, or the influence he was trying to build up, to effect his restoration to Athens at the same time that he was trying to convince the Athenian fleet, based on Samos, that he was the man to negotiate an Athenian-Persian alliance against Sparta. So what he wants to do is build up favor with the Persians, then talk to Athens that he can negotiate an alliance. And an alliance with the Persians would be so valuable, it would ensure victory in the Peloponnesian War, that they would overlook his treachery completely and perhaps he could be restored. But he knew that this wouldn't be possible with Athens' current form of government. It would only be possible if an oligarchy gained political control in Athens. He thought that what he called the radical democracy there would never agree to him being recalled to the city. Him, an aristocrat, a rich boy, that rank and file Athenians and the populace thought that he was insulting their gods and their soldiers, so he was popular with the elites, but not with the populace, so this is what he had to do. So what he started to do is exchange messages with the Athenian leaders at Samos and suggested that they could install an oligarchy friendly to him, and if they did that, he would return to Athens and bring with him Persian money and possibly the Persian fleet of 147 triremes. This is a significant navy at the time when every ship counted. So what Alcibiades did was begin working over the most influential military officers to trigger a coup and install an oligarchy. And he was successful. And he did this by offering them a threefold plan. First, that the Athenian constitution be changed. Second, that he, Alcibiades, be recalled and that this recall be voted on. And that third, Alcibiades, as part of his plan, that he would win over Tissaphernes, the satrap of Persia, and the king of Persia to the Athenian side. So you might wonder, why would Athenian officers agree to this? What was in it for them? Well, most of the officers in the Athenian fleet accepted the plan, and they welcomed the prospect of a narrower constitution because this would give them a greater share in determining policy. And it succeeded. Alcibiades' plan to convince them succeeded. They really liked the idea of a possible Persian alliance. And so democracy gave way to an oligarchy of 400. And again, I just want to stress how incredible this is that Alcibiade says this. This is our hypothetical alternate Benedict Arnold. He says to America, look, in the War of 1812, I can bring over the French to our side. The British will stop fighting you. But you need to let me come back in to America, and you need to get rid of the current form of government and replace it with the Articles of Confederation or a completely different form of government altogether. So you got to give Alcibiade's credit. He really knows how to work an angle and do things in his favor. So just when you think that Alcibiade's, his loyalties can't be more fleeting or complicated, here's what he does next. He emerges in 411 BC as a champion of Athenian democracy after he triggered a coup to overthrow the democratic structure with an oligarchy. He does this with the Athenian navy at Samos. He is not back in Athens yet. He hasn't been fully welcomed back into the fold. At Samos, there was a similar coup instigated by the conspirators who overthrew Athenian democracy. But this coup in Samos to overthrow the democratic order, it didn't go forward nearly smoothly. The Democrats there in Samos, they learned of the conspiracy and they notified prominent Athenians, including the generals Leon and Diomedon, and also Thrasybulus and Thrasyllus. At the time, he was a hoplite in the ranks. So with the support of these men and the Athenian soldiers, the Democrats in Samos were able to hold back the 300 Samian oligarchs who attempted to seize power there. Also, the Athenian troops at Samos formed themselves into a political assembly. They deposed their generals and elected new ones. So what Alcibiades does is put himself on the side of the Democrats, only the Democrats in Samos, not the ones in Athens. The navy at Samos made Alcibiades a strategos and their pro-democracy. And despite the 400 in Athens are replaced by a wider oligarchy of 5,000, Alcibiades leads the fleet to victory over the Spartans at a battle in the Hellespont, which is today the Dardanelles that connects the Sea of Marmara to the Aegean Sea. Alcibiades is successful at a battle there in 410 BC. So, I mean, what can you say about Alcibiades at this point? He's playing every side, every political system. And Aristophanes, the playwright, has a comment here about this. It's, what is each man's opinion of Alcibiades? If Athens longs for him, but at the same time hates him, at the same, on the balance, it must have him. So he's indispensable, even though no one really trusts him and a lot of people don't like him and many people wish him dead. Now, I want to take a step back here with the life of Alcibiades, and I want to introduce a different political concept here. And that has to do with, and bear with me, the deep state. And don't think about 21st century politics when I talk about this. 21st century politics, there are different conspiracies about hidden actors who work behind the elected democratic order to actually control what's going on. If there's any merit to that idea of people who are working outside traditional halls of power and pulling strings, Alcibiades is someone who could sort of fit that description. And I'm using some ideas here from military historian Victor Davis Hansen. What he argues, and he actually wrote a great book on the Peloponnesian War, and he describes Alcibiades as this person who's operating above normal political power. Hansen argues that all great empires of the past created deep states. These are permanent bureaucracies. These are elites that hang on. They adapt as imperial conditions change. So you see the same faces, even though political systems change, governments change. You could see this in imperial Spain, in the Escorial court outside of Madrid, the courts of Renaissance Venice, in Byzantium's Constantinople, the thousands who lived at 18th century Versailles. They're full of court functionaries who, even when they're out of power, they're scheming to regain power and still working their connections. So these are the people who cause nonstop drama of intrigues and coups, and they seem immune to changes, even when there's changes in autocratic heads of state. For example, the Byzantine Emperor Justinian, he curbed the influence of his bureaucratic opponents through the slaughter of the Nika riots in 532. But these careerists, these deep state operatives, were always able to survive, even more so than public servants. So Alcibiades was an Athenian democratic imperialist. He was a suspected oligarchic sympathizer. He was a wanted outlaw of the Athenian state. He was a turncoat working for Sparta. He returned as a champion of Athenian democracy. Then he became an aristocratic exile under the protection of Persia. If there's a common denominator in all these things, it's that he was a manipulative, skilled survivor in the politics of the Greek city-state system. And if you want to look at other later examples of someone like Alcibiades, you have the French minister Charles Maurice de Terlinde-Périgord. Sorry, probably totally mispronounced that, but bear with me, listeners. He was, for more than 40 years, a fixture of the permanent Paris court. And he was an advocate and betrayer of the Ancien regime during the French Revolution. He was involved in the French Revolution. He was involved in the Napoleonic Revolution. He was involved in the restored monarchy. So his loyalty was to his career rather than to France itself, much less to the monarchy, the revolution, the republican government, or the dictatorship. And Alcibiades' military and political talents proved invaluable to whichever state currently held his allegiance. But through this process, he's constantly making powerful enemies, which means that he never stays in one place for very long. And by the end of the Peloponnesian War, his days of political relevance slowly wane, and that's what leads to his downfall, because he's only important and helpful as long as he is useful to people. So that's just a little bit of a digression of Alcibiades. And how does he constantly switch sides like this, and how does he constantly survive? He is a born survivor whose highest instinct is foremost to himself. Okay, so let's get back to when he is no longer in exile in Athens, but hasn't quite yet returned to Athens and isn't yet completely welcomed back into the fold. From 411 to 408 BC, he helps Athens to a spectacular recovery in the Peloponnesian War. He defeats a Spartan fleet in the Hellespont and Abdios in 411, Cisseus in 410, and he regains control over the grain route from the Black Sea. So Athens is able to get its necessary provisions and feed its people, feed its army, and feed its navy. These successes encourage Alcibiades to return in 407 to Athens, where he's welcomed with great enthusiasm and given supreme control over the entire war effort. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Alcibiades returns to the city in triumph in 407, but before he does that, he has to make sure that this isn't another trap and a conspiracy to try to kill him. Even in the wake of his military victories, Alcibiades was very careful in his return. He was mindful how the government had changed to an oligarchy, and charges over the insulting the statues of Hermes were still technically hanging over his head, and he had done great injury to Athens when he was fighting on behalf of Sparta. So Alcibiades doesn't go straight home to Athens. He first goes to Samos, he picks up 20 ships, and proceeds with him to the Cerameic Gulf. So he has forces, and people are going to be not as quick to mess with him. He then collects 100 talents of gold. Good to have money on your person in a sticky situation. He then gathers intelligence about the mood in Athens about his return, and his inquiries assure him that the city was kindly disposed toward him and that his closest friends urge him to return. So he finally sails to a port city near Athens where the crowd had gathered, and they wanted to see the famous Alcibiades. He enters the harbor full of fear, but then his fear goes away when he sees his cousin and others of his friends and acquaintances there who invite him to the land. Once he's on shore, he's greeted with a hero's welcome. But nevertheless, people are still suspicious of him, and they see an evil omen in his return. And the evil omen is that he returned to Athens on the day when the ceremony of the Plyntaria, the feast where the old statue of Athena would get cleansed, was being celebrated. This was considered by many people as the unluckiest day of the year to undertake anything of importance. So Alcibiades' enemies took note of this, and they kept it in mind for a future occasion. They could mention it to the population again if they wanted to stir up a revolt. Well, Alcibiades, for the moment, all is well. The old charges against him are dropped, and as a reward for his efforts, he was made strategos, autokrator, once again. But this time, he is above all other generals, and this is the only time in the history of Athens when this happens. I mean, imagine our Benedict Arnold returns to America. He's made supreme commander-in-chief. He is like John Pershing during World War I, or Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander, and completely restored with all of his power, all of his offices, and then some. Now he's Commander-in-Chief of the Athenian Armed Forces. Things go well for him at first. He quashes a rebellion at Andros. This is followed by an expedition to fight in northern Ionia. And he has success after success after success, but he makes a mistake here. While he's occupied in Ionia, he leaves another officer, Antikos, in charge of the fleet at Samos. Unfortunately for Athens, the Spartan commander Lysander took advantage of the situation of Alcibiades' absence, and he defeats the Athenian navy in 406 BC. Lysander had formed an alliance with Persia, and this alliance would eventually result in the defeat of Athens in the Peloponnesian War. So the Athenian navy was in Alcibiades' absence. It suffers a defeat at the hands of the Spartans. Alcibiades' enemies then eventually persuaded the people to reject him. He was stripped of his command and recalled to Athens to face trial again for treason. Some thought that perhaps he had worked another angle with the Persians and planned for his absence at that defeat there so he wouldn't be directly blamed. There are all sorts of conspiracies. Everything possible is lobbed against him. And with Alcibiades, it's so hard to know for true what was really going on because he's constantly playing an angle. And he remains an influence on Athenian politics. And the problem is that he destroys hopes of a political consensus. So the Athenians faced Sparta and the Hellespont. They grew careless, and he warns them of their danger. The Athenians lose. Their entire fleet is attacked by the Spartan admiral Lysander in 405 BC. Because of this terrible defeat against the Athenian navy, Alcibiades is blamed. Treason is talked about against him. He realizes that despite his hero welcome back in Athens, despite his incredible power given to him, once again, he's no longer safe in Athens. And because his loyalties to others were so fickle, others' loyalty to him was fickle in return. Alcibiades then returns to Phrygia, where he took refuge in Asia Minor. This is in northwestern Asia Minor, with the Persian governor. And this Persian governor is induced by the Spartans to have Alcibiades murdered. This is not a safe haven. The Persians don't do a lot to protect him. The Spartans and the Athenians both want him dead at this point. Alcibiades, like Themistocles before him, he sought the favor of the Persians, and he turned to a satrap that he knew named Pharnavaz. What he wanted to do was secure the aid of the Persians, and specifically King Artaxerxes, or Emperor Artaxerxes. And what Alcibiades was planning was to get their support and use it against Sparta, that they would join a military alliance against Sparta, and that would allow Athens to win the Peloponnesian War. And I should mention that for him to go to Persia, there were several Greek aristocrats who took refuge in the Achaemenid Empire when they lost favor at home. Others were Themistocles and others. In general, these people were welcomed by the Achaemenid kings, and they received land grants to support them, and they ruled in various cities of Asia Minor. The Achaemenids thought, might as well have these people get their support so that they're trying to curry favor with us, they won't try to attack us, and if we can keep Greece disunified, then they're never going to come out against us. And when Greece is fully unified, as what happens with Alexander the Great, yes, it is definitely destructive to Persia. So that's how Persia is always trying to play different Greek city-states off of each other. But it seems likely at this time that however useful Alcibiades could have been to Persia, Persia also wanted him dead. Later on, Pharnavaz denied responsibility for the eventual assassination of Alcibiades. He claimed, or this could have actually been true, that a local Phrygian family was seeking revenge for Alcibiades by seducing the family's daughter. So maybe Persia was doing a hit on them to curry favor with this local Phrygian family. We don't know. So there's a lot about Alcibiades' death that's uncertain. There's conflicting accounts about it. According to one of the oldest accounts, the Spartans, and especially Lysander, were responsible. Plutarch's version is this. Lysander sent an envoy to the Persian satrap, who then dispatched his brother to Phrygia, and here Alcibiades is living with his mistress Timandra. In 404 BC, as he was about to set out for the Persian court and try to win support from the Achaemenid emperor, Alcibiades' residence was surrounded and set on fire. He saw that he had no chance of escape, so he rushed out to his assassins with his dagger in hand, and he was killed by a shower of arrows. According to Aristotle, the site of Alcibiades' death was Elaphus, which is a mountain in Phrygia. So what do we make of Alcibiades? Eventually, Athens loses the Peloponnesian War. Sparta becomes the dominant city-state in the region, and much of the blame should be Alcibiades' fate because he joins the Spartans. He gives them critical intelligence. They cut off the Athenians. They lose victories. With all of his meddling in Athens, people never unite together decisively. He switches over forms of government from a democracy to an oligarchy. And what Plutarch noted about Alcibiades is that if ever a man was ruined by his own glory, it was Alcibiades. He had fame, he had glory, he was charismatic, he could convince people of things, but he didn't have farsighted judgment. And if there's a theme to this episode, I would say, what does it look like if you have a person with enormous talent, you have enormous potential, but they don't quite reach the pantheon of greatness that we think of great figures in history? And the reason that Alcibiades doesn't have this is, again, going back to Victor Davis Hanson's take on this, because he's an authority on the Peloponnesian War, is that Alcibiades lacks strategic foresight. I'll explain what that means, and then I'll compare him to people who do have this ability, and they show the foresight and tact that Alcibiades lacked. Ancient Greeks believed that true leadership in crisis came down to what they called pronoia. It's a Greek word for strategic foresight. There were some statesmen like Pericles and some Themistocles that had it. They did have foresight. They were able to put together long-term peace. They didn't lose their vision in times of defeat when they lost battles, but they stayed to their vision. They didn't defect. They didn't try to abandon one system and go after another, but they stayed true and stayed consistent. But Alcibiades lacked strategic foresight. So what foresight means in a crisis, what Hansen and others define it, this Greek word, it means sizing up a nation's assets, debits, all of their resources, and maximizing their advantages and minimizing liabilities. A leader with foresight, especially in times of defeat or despair, can chart a rational pathway to victory. This is a George Washington charting a pathway to victory during Valley Forge. This is in World War I, after the Allied defeats against the Central Powers. They're able to marshal their resources and attack in, let's say, the Mediterranean. Instead of continuing to remain at the trenches in France. So in such a crisis, leaders don't fall into panic and depression or abandon their city-state and join with an enemy, and they're not beholden to popular opinion. When people say that they're being ridiculous when the population is about to charge them with treason, they don't run away. At the same time, when they said that they're geniuses or maybe even demigods, they don't believe all the hype about them. Rudyard Kipling described such a ability, strategic foresight like this. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing their heads and blaming it on you. Or if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln knew the overwhelming material advantages of the Union could eventually defeat the South, but only if he could hold the nation together after disasters like the Battles of Bull Run and Chancellorsville, and only once he found his generals like William Tecumseh Sherman and Ulysses S. Grant, and in World War II, Winston Churchill proved that he was perhaps the most impressive wartime leader because he saw that the British assets that he held, they were still greater than Germany's, even though Germany was on the rise, even in the absolute worst times in the war. In 1940, after Dunkirk, after the bombing of Britain or bombing of London, eventually, despite the razor-thin margins of error that Churchill and others held, he was able to use these assets and ensure victory. So Churchill assured that Britain had a greater navy and Germany didn't. Britain would soon have allies like America and Russia, and they were far stronger than German partners like Italy and Japan. So he could foresee that the economies of those alliances would be superior to those of the Axis. And he saw all of this even though defeat loomed over Britain, and there were people in his own party who called for him to negotiate with Adolf Hitler. Franklin Roosevelt had similar foresight after Pearl Harbor. He unleashed private enterprise to rearm America when he knew would happen at an astonishing rate. And he promised victory not because he knew it would be easy or quick, but he just calculated the assets that America had and made the right choices. And he didn't listen to predictions of doom and he didn't get rattled even after terrible defeats that happened early in the war. He reminded the United States why and how they would win in the worst parts of the war. And his confidence wasn't just based on blind optimism, but on rational calculation and optimism. So Alcibiades was incredibly capable. He was rich, he was gifted, he was charismatic, but he didn't have strategic foresight. He was constantly switching allegiances. He constantly threw in his hat with different groups of people. He was a charming figure. He was a charming scoundrel. He is really fun to study, but that's why he is not a great leader for the ages, and he is known foremost as a chameleon. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thanks for sticking with me all the way to the end. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't thank the Spymasters or History Unplugged who make this podcast possible. I'll explain what Spymasters are in a second. Here they are, some real names, some aliases. Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Los, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at wmwguitars.com, Belivy, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Michael from New York and Vermont, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Harrington, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.